I should also mention that I'm currently also at NSF working with Tomek. And I would like to thank the organizers very much for inviting me to this meeting. And I thought, since we are meeting in honor of Andreas, that I'd spend a few minutes before we get to the mathematics talking about how I know Andreas. And so when I finished graduate school, one of my first postdocs was at University of Michigan. And I would give talks in the combinatorics seminar there. And there was this logician who kept coming to the seminars. And in the middle of my talk, a hand would go up, and Andreas would say, have you considered this, or do you know how to do that? Or it might happen that at the end of the talk, I would mention some open problem that I'd been struggling with and couldn't get anywhere with. So a few days would pass, and then a note would appear in my cubbyhole, this being in the Middle Ages before there was email. Or I would pass Andreas in the hall, and he would say, remember that question that was raised in your talk? I think I have an answer. And of course, Andreas is very modest. I think I have an answer is code for, I have a proof. So Andreas would show me the proof, and we would end up working on the problem together and would invariably end up writing a joint paper, which was much better than what I had originally envisaged. And so I really am thankful for knowing him. He has very much enriched my mathematical life. And one of the reasons that I chose this talk is because you will see that it is an open problem. In fact, you could think of this more as a cry for help than a talk. And I'm fully expecting early next week to get an email. Don't let me put you on the spot here by saying, Bruce, remember that problem you had in your talk? I think I know how to solve it. Okay, so let me also talk about the history behind this particular talk, because it also relates to Andreas, well, more to the University of Michigan. So when I was a postdoc there, Frank Harari was still on the faculty, and he was in a phase. Frank was like the moon. He went through various phases. This particular phase was taking theorems, existing theorems in combinatorics, and turning them into games that he could play. So, and he would use the fact that a certain object had to exist because of this theorem as a way to determine when the game would terminate. And we're going to see that in a second, a particular example of that in this talk. So he did this with the Erdős-Szekeres theorem, which, if you don't know already, actually there are many Erdős-Szekeres theorems. I'll tell you which one I'm talking about in a second. We looked at this game and got some very modest results, so modest that we published the result in a very obscure Italian journal, and I thought it would never see the light of day again. And then a couple of years ago, I was corresponding with Michael Albert at University of Otago in New Zealand by email about something. And I should say, the people in Otago work on mathematical problems in a very unique, at least for mathematicians, way. They have a group of people, the theory group here. I haven't put all their names down because there's half a dozen of them in the group. But they pick a problem, and then they work on it together, as you would a problem in physics or chemistry. They all get together, they brainstorm, everybody's name goes on the paper, no matter what your contribution, figuring that over time this will even out. And Michael mentioned to me that they were looking for a problem to work on, and I said, well, you know, there's this old paper that I wrote with Frank Harari and David West where we were never able to figure out the complete solution, and it might interest you because I knew that it used ideas that they had been interested in the past. And so I got Michael a copy of the paper, and he looked at it and he said, yeah, this is really interesting, let's work on it. And I became an honorary member of the group thanks to email during the process, and we still weren't able to solve this. So we did what every self-respecting mathematician does in such a situation. You look for other similar problems that you can say something about. And that's basically what's going to happen in this talk. So here's a little outline. So this particular game that we're going to talk about can be done on any partially ordered set you want. We'll start off with the original game, which is just on an interval in the integers. Then we'll talk about the stuff that we were able to do with the Otago group, talking about playing it on the rationals. And then with a section which I call, with apologies to Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart, eine kleine Game-Theorie, just enough game theory for you to be able to understand the proof of one of my favorite results from the paper. And then I'll end with some open questions, which won't be open after next week, so don't worry about those. If you're interested in details, I know it's very hard to take notes with a slide presentation. There is a paper on my website, and so they are all easily available there. Okay, so what is the game, the initial game? And I apologize for the green. I know it's not very readable. When I gave this talk once before, the green was even worse, so I changed it, and it's a little better, but it's not great. And so if you can't read something, stop me, and I'll be happy to make it clear what's going on. So brackets n will just be the integers from 1 to n. Yeah, maybe turning off the lights will help, see if that gives it a... Oh. No. Is that better? Oh, good. And now you can go to sleep and I won't know. Just please don't snore. Okay. Sn is going to be the symmetric group of permutations on 1 through n. You should think of these in one-line form, right? So not as functions, but just as take the numbers 1 through n and write them down in some order. And so a subsequence of a permutation, well, is just what you think. You take out some set of the x's and keep them in order, right? And we will say that a subsequence is increasing or decreasing, again, obvious definition. It's increasing if the x's go up, it's decreasing if the x's go down. And the length is the number of elements in the sequence. And either type of sequence is called monotone. And here's the other second, it's a simple concept, but give an example just to make sure we're all on the same page. So if I have the permutation 6, 4, 1, 3, 2, 5, then I could look at 1, 3, and 5, right? Those are here. So that's a subsequence, and it's clearly increasing of length 3. 6, 4, 3 is a decreasing one of length 3, so forth and so on. Okay. So what is this famous theorem that I keep talking about? Suppose I have a permutation of mn plus 1 elements, right? So m and n are fixed, and you've got some list of the first mn plus 1 elements. It then must have either an increasing subsequence of length m plus 1 or a decreasing sequence of length n plus 1. So essentially this is saying if you let the number of elements you're permuting be large enough, you're guaranteed, it's a kind of Ramsey-like thing, right? You're either guaranteed a sufficiently large increasing sequence or a sufficiently large decreasing subsequence. Okay? And there's a very beautiful pigeonhole principle proof of this, which unfortunately I don't have time to give, but I'll be happy to show anybody if they're interested after the talk. It's not hard to prove. So this is an audience participation talk, so I'm going to turn on the lights for just a second. So let's suppose m is 2 and n is 3. So mn plus 1, if you put that into your Cray computer and let it crank for a while, will tell you is 7. So I'd like a permutation of random, semi-random, maybe not random at all. What's your favorite permutation in S7, anybody? And we need 7. Okay, so what is this theorem saying? It says no matter what permutation he gave me, either I can find one more than this, 3 elements increasing, or one more than this, 4 elements decreasing. Well, luckily that's easy to do because he started right off with 1, 3, 5. So thank you, I'll pay you later for that. For making it easy, I'm making it hard to find this sequence that satisfies this. And whatever sequence he had picked, I would always be able to do this, either find 3 increasing or 4 decreasing. Okay? So that's that. We'll leave this on for a second. see if there's more green on there, because there's, yes, question. Is there any, no, just a cough. Okay. No, I better turn it off right now. Okay, so as I said, Frank Harari proposed the following game that I also studied with him and with, this is David West, not Doug West, in case those of you that know Doug. Anyway, so suppose I'm given my two parameters, M and N, and what we're going to do is we take the numbers from 1 to MN plus 1 as our playing cards, if you think. You start with an empty sequence, and then you take the two players, call them A and B, take turns playing numbers from this set of numbers, right? So pair A picks some number from that set as the first element of my sequence. Then player B picks some different thing to be the second, right? So we're essentially trying to build up a permutation on these numbers, right, from left to right. And then, because of the Erdős-Sekeres theorem, we know at some point we've got to get an m plus 1 length increasing subsequence or an n plus 1 length decreasing subsequence, and we can let that be the winning criterion, right? The first person who's able to get force such a sequence to exist, and we know at some point somebody's going to have to be able to do that, call that person the winner. Okay? Is everybody clear what the game is? That's the basic idea for the whole talk. So let's pick a simple example. Again, the lights. Suppose m is 1 and n is 3, so mn plus 1 is, so we're going to deal with the numbers 1 through 4, and let's play the game, and I need a victim, oh, sorry, a volunteer, and Andreas has just volunteered. So Andreas, please come to the board. Or for decreasing. And which would you prefer to go first or second?
Well, let's see. If I go first, I don't have to think, do I?
No, you don't.
Because if I play anything other than four, you will beat me on the first move.
Exactly.
So I think I'll
play the four.
Play four.
Does everybody agree that this is probably a good idea? Now I have to think, but not too hard. The only thing I can play, if I'm not going to lose on the very next move, is going to be three, and therefore Andreas has to play.
I have to play two.
Two
on the next move.
Okay. So, thank you. A round of applause for our guest player. Okay. So I think it's clear when the parameter m is 1 that you have to build a decreasing sequence, otherwise you're going to lose immediately, and therefore who wins just depends upon the parity of n, right? If the decreasing sequence is of odd length, then the first player wins, and if it's of even length, as it was in this case, the second player will win. Okay, so that gives you some idea of how you could analyze this at least when m is 1. And also, let's notice that the game is symmetric in M and N. If I exchange M and N, it doesn't matter. You can just reverse all the inequalities. So we might as well always assume that one of them is bigger. So here's a chart of what happens when M is less than or equal to N. First, this is really trivial, right? I put down any number, I win. We just saw that this is the alternating one, right? That's the one that I just played with Andreas. With a little bit, but not much more work, you can show that when M is 2, the first player always wins. And after that, we really don't know what happens. These guys were figured out by exhaustive computer search. But we do, as I said, the open problem, right at the beginning of the talk, is we do not know who wins this game in general, and we would love to. So if any of you have bright ideas, I've worked on this twice now, and it's defeated me twice. So I would dearly love anybody, I don't care, Andreas or anybody else in the audience, I would love to know who wins this game. Yes?
Assume that M is at most N, therefore
equal. Yes.
Then this same line, the M factor, goes first.
No, M and N aren't the names of the players. The players are A and B. M and N are the lengths of the sequences. Yes.
Go to the first place. So, no. The
The game is not to get the high win if it's increasing and he wins if it's decreasing.
Right, either.
Whoever gets either of them first wins.
Yeah, they're both looking for the same two. There are two possible ways to win, and it's both of them are available to both players. Does it make sense now? Good. Other questions? Please stop me, because, I mean, if this is not clear, the rest of the talk is not going to make much sense. And I specifically picked this, since I'm a combinatorialist, and I knew I was going to be talking to a group of logicians mainly, so that it doesn't require any background. Any other questions? Okay, so where do we go from here? Well, as I said, what do? We try and do this on some other part, right? Obviously, we can take any partially ordered set we like and play where increasing just means you're taking, have a chain in increasing order, and decreasing means you have a chain in decreasing order. So what happens if we play it on something dense like the rationals? Well, then something very interesting happens. So we're going to, as we with same rules, we're building up my sequence from the left to the right. As we build it, we're also going to build something called the increasing list. What does the increasing list look like? Well, you start with the empty sequence, and then suppose at some point your increasing list looks like y1, y2, so it's going to be a list of increasing elements. And suppose you're at the point where xi, the ith element of my sequence, is being picked. Then what you do is you scan your increasing list from left to right, and you find the first yj, which is larger than xi, and that yj gets replaced by xi. So you take the element from your that you're putting in your sequence, and you put it somewhere in the list, and this is the place where you put it. You get rid of the first thing larger than it. And if there's nothing larger than it, you just put it at the very end. Okay? I'll give you an example very quickly. So, right, beginning of the game, we don't have anything here, our list is empty. First player picks 4. So 4, well, the list is empty, so there's nothing bigger than it, so it just gets appended to the end, the empty thing. Well, that means it just sits in the I list, right? If you pen 4 to the empty sequence, you get 4. Next play, say, is 2. So the 2 now looks at the increasing list, and it finds the first thing. Well, there's only one thing bigger than it, namely the 4. So the 2 looks at the 4, says, aha, you're bigger than me, so it replaces the 4 in the list. And now the list consists only of the 4. The 2 has gone away. I'm sorry, consists only of the 2. The 4 has gone away. Say the next thing we try is the 5. The 5 looks at the list and says, aha, there's nothing in the list that's larger than me, so I append it to the end of the list. So it's now 2, 5. Now, say I play the 3. The 3 goes along, well, the 2 is too small. The 5 is the first thing greater than it, so the 3 removes the 5 from the list, etc., etc. Right, the 1 would replace the 2 because it's the first thing bigger than it, and the 6 sits at the end of the list because it's larger than everything. It's clear how this list is built. There's something called the Robinson-Schenstedt-Knuth correspondence, which this is actually just a very special part of. So we didn't come up with this. And in fact, there's a very famous, at least famous in the circles I go in, theorem of Craigie-Schenstedt, which says that if, when I take the xith element, I'm considering that in my permutation, if it gets placed in the jth column of the list, then j is the length of a longest increasing subsequence ending at that place. So every time something from my permutation goes into the list, the place where it goes to the list tells me how long of an increasing subsequence I can get ending at that element. So, for example, right? Where was the 6 placed? The 6 was placed here, which was in the third position. That tells me that there must be, in this permutation, an increasing sequence of length 3, which ends with the 6. And indeed, there is, right? 2, 3, 6 is one example of such a sequence. So essentially, by putting these guys into the list just keeps track of how long my increasing sequences are at any point, and so the length of the list at the end will tell you the length of the longest increasing subsequence, right? Because if I put something in this final column here, well, I must have something that ended there of that length, and since I didn't put something in the column next to it, there can't be anything of length longer than that. So this is a way of keeping track of what we're looking for. But of course, we don't have to just play that with increasing things, but we can do the whole thing with a decreasing list just by reversing all the inequalities, right? So start with the empty thing, then the 4 comes in, so that gets appended. The 2 now will not bump the 4, right? Because now things, instead of replacing the first thing bigger, you replace the first thing smaller. Well, there is nothing smaller than 2 here. So the 2 will just get appended at the end of the list. And again, you come in the 5. The 5 goes to the first thing smaller. The first thing smaller is the 4 and replaces it, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So now we have two lists. And of course, you've got the analogous statement in the theorem about decreasing sequences. So knowing the lengths of the two lists tells you at each point in your play how long you can find increasing and decreasing subsequences. It turns out, though, and as I said, this method is something that was well known in the community. But what gave us power was the ability to combine the two lists in the following way. So the things in the combined list are going to be of three types. There's going to be reds, blues, and purples. Luckily, all of those show up pretty well on the slide. And here's the meaning of those symbols. If an element is in the increasing list but not the decreasing list, I'll color it red. So red means in the increasing list, not the decreasing one. Blue means the other, that it's in the decreasing list but not in the increasing list. And what's purple? Purple is red plus blue, so purple means it's in both. Okay. So again, this is the same example we were using. Here's what the combined list would look like. Empty. 4 is now in both, so that would be represented by a purple element. Next, right, 2 is now in both. 4 is only in this list, so it becomes blue. 2 and 5 are in both lists, so they're both purple. This hopefully is, right, not rocket science here. And you might also say, well, you're not doing anything here, right? I mean, you're just taking the two lists and creating a third list. This doesn't give you any power if you have to have the first two lists in order to compute the third one. The crucial thing is that you don't need the other two lists to compute the third one. You can compute the third one on its own without ever going through the computation for the first two. And here's how you do it. Let's call red and purple reddish, right? Because they both have red in them. And draining red means you replace, well, if you drain red from something that's red, there's nothing left, right? So you just drain red away and you're left with the empty list. And draining red from purple, of course, just leaves you with blue. If you remove the red from something purple, you get blue. Similarly, you can drain blue, which either eliminates a blue element or changes a purple element into red. And here's how you construct the list. Start with the empty list. Each time you have an XI, each new XI corresponds to a new purple element, right? Because when you insert a new guy, it's going to go into both lists. And then what you do is you need to make adjustments for, right, this new element may have bumped things out of the other lists. And the way that's reflected in this context is you drain red from the closest reddish element to the right of this purple, and you drain blue from the closest bluish element to the left. And if you just work through the semantics here, this is saying exactly the same thing as creating the two lists, but let me go through the example so you can see how it works. Okay, so how do I do, so forget about these two lists. I'm just going to compute this all by itself. So the 4 comes in and it's purple, right? Whenever an element enters, it's purple. Next, the 2 comes in. The 2 is less than the purple, so the 2 is going to go on this side, right? So that I'm going to insert a purple element on this side, and then how do I adjust the rest of the list? Well, I have to drain red from the reddish, closest reddish element to the right. Well, here's a reddish element to the right. In fact, it's the only reddish element to the right, so I have to drain red from it. What does draining red from it leave? Blue. And I have to drain stuff from the left, but there is nothing to the left, so I can forget about that. That's trivial. So, right, this too is purple, and it's drained the red from this, leaving a blue element. Now I have to insert the 5. The 5 is going to insert at this end, and again, it's the same thing. This is going to come in as a purple element. There's nothing to the right to drain from. From the left, it takes the closest element, which is the floor, the 4, drains the blue from it, but if it drains the blue from it, it's going to disappear and give you 2 purples. And continue that way. Right. Okay, so why does this do anything for you aside from make the computation shorter? It really reflects what's happening in the Q game, because think about it. When you were using the numbers 1 through mn plus 1, if I play, as we played with Andreas, if you play the highest element, I am forced to play elements lower than it. But if I play a 4 as my first move, I could as well play 40 or minus 400 or 1/4, right? Because the rules are dense. It doesn't matter what my first move is. So therefore, that's represented by just a purple element, right? Because there is, in all intents and purposes, only 1 first move. Similarly, there's only 2 second moves, right? I either play something higher than the first element or lower than the, it doesn't matter which, and that's reflected by the fact that there's only 2 other, depending, you either insert a new purple element here or a new purple element there. So this is taking an infinite number of moves that you could make for your first move and just encoding it as a single move. This is a labor-saving device. So using that, we were able to figure out a chart like we had before for the other one. And you can see we were able to do it in more cases when we were keeping m small and letting n go to infinity. Let's see. Things are... I'm going to... Oh, I still have 15 minutes, right? Because I started a quarter of... Oh, good. So this is one of the proofs that I like the most in the paper, and it shows the power of this way of looking at the game. For one thing, it's one of the only results we have. Notice, all of the results I've showed you so far have kept one of the parameters small and let the other parameter go off to infinity. This is one where both of them are going to go off to infinity, and here's how we get a handle on it. So suppose G is any game which is last player to move wins, and suppose it has no draw positions, which is the case that we're in. So most of you are probably familiar. You can draw a game tree, right? So A is the initial position of the game. Then on the first move, I can move either to position B or to position C. If I end up in B, player B can move me either to D or to E, etc., right? Usual way that you construct such things. So the nodes are just the positions of the game, and the children of the node are the positions that are reachable in one move from that position. Notice, from B or C, I can go to E. So these two things are kind of, it's redundant to have them both there. So what we're usually going to deal with, I'll call T bar, and it's just the digraph you get by amalgamating, right, children of a vertex if they have the same outcome. I mean, we're getting to the same position, so we might as well. It's no longer a tree, but that's okay. That's not going to be useful, the treeness. Okay, so here's the important thing. So what we're going to do is we're going to label the nodes of my tree as follows, with either an N or a P, and this is not the same N that appeared until next talk. This is N is the label of my node B if the next player going from that position has a winning strategy. So, right, if I'm at a node here and this node is an N node, that means whoever is playing along either, right, the next player to move, who's going to take me either to D or E, that's the guy who wins. P means the previous player wins. So if I put a P here, it means whoever moved me to that node has the winning strategy. So why is that useful? Well, you can find out who the winner is then. Think about it. This is the last player to move wins. So all the terminal nodes here, all the leaves, if you like, have got to be labeled P, right? Because when I whoever moved me here was the winner, and that was the previous person, right? The person just previous to that moved me along this edge is the winner, and therefore that those are all P nodes. So I can start off labeling these guys all as P. We know they're P. And now what I do is kind of a reverse inductive thing. I work my way back up the tree, labeling with N's and P's, and once I get to the root, if I can label the root, N or P, I'll know who the, right, who the person is that wins. So how do I do that? Okay, there's two rules. Think about it first. What if I'm at a node such as this one where there's a P child? Well, clearly, if I'm the guy who's sitting here, I'm going to want to move there, right? Because if I move there, I will become the previous player once I do that move, and I'll win, right? This is saying that the person that made the move along this edge wins, and therefore, if I'm here, I'm going to move there because that's a final and winning position. So that means that these nodes that have P as a child are N nodes. The person who's about to play is going to win, because they can go to a winning position right here. So these nodes, therefore, are all N's, right? Because this has a P, this has a P, and this has a P. What's the only other possibility? Well, if I don't have a child that's a P, then all of the childs must be N's, such as in this position. What does that mean? Well, it means that the next player is always going to win from all of the possible... Right, I'm sitting here and I'm looking at these possibilities. In all of them, the next player wins. Well, the next player isn't me, unfortunately, right? If I'm here, I'm this player, and so my opponent is the next player from all of these positions. So that means I'm not going to win, and that means the previous, if everything is N, the previous player must be the person that's going to win. And so therefore, here, the previous person, previous here is fictitious, right? The person that, there wasn't any previous person to move into that node, but that's because we consider that as B moving a fictitious node at move at the beginning of the game, right? If this were an N node, then it would make real sense, right? The next player is the first player. P at the top means it was the previous player, that means player B has got to be the player who wins. So there's just a summary of the two rules again to work up your tree. If there's a P child, then the parent is labeled N, and if all of the children are labeled N, then you label P. So here's a way to prove the following result, which I don't know how you could prove it by any other method, but I'd be interested if there were one, because who knows, it might be useful on the other games. Suppose we look along the diagonal. When M is equal to N, A always wins. First player always wins. How can I prove that? Well, it's not hard given the tools. Look at the top part of the tree. So this is going to be kind of weird, right? Usually when you're trying to do this in a game tree, you start with the leaves and percolate your way back up. Here we're going to start at the top. Why can we start at the top? Well, we're going to do this by contradiction. Suppose A was not the winner. Well, if A was not the winner, that means the label of this top element here is P. Remember P, that fictitious previous thing? So if A is not the winner, B is the winner, and therefore we have P at the top. And now let's work our way down. Think about it. If this is labeled P, then all of its children must be N. Well, it only has one child, but that's okay. That gets us a little further down. So that node must be N. What about these two children? Well, because of this one of them must be P. But what are these two positions? These two positions are what are called symmetric, because think about it. You played the first one, and then you either played below or you played above. Right, to get to that position for those two guys. But remember, we're in the case where M and N are equal. You're looking for increasing and decreasing sequences of the same length. So if you have a winning strategy for playing above, well, you could play below and just reverse all the inequalities, right? Because the lengths haven't changed. So whatever the labels are of these two guys, they have to be the same. They're symmetric. And one of them must be P, so they must both be P. There's no other possibility, because if they're equal and they're both N, then we have a problem. So if they're equal and we have to have at least one P, actually we both have to be P. By the way, and this will be important in just a sec, there's an easy way to know when positions are symmetric, when they must have the same label. What you do is take one color sequence, read it backwards, as you might expect, because you're exchanging increasing and decreasing, and then change all the B's to R's and vice versa. Interchange blue and red. P stay constant. So that's exactly what you do here, right? Read this backwards, and then change the blue to a red, and you get this one. Okay, so now we have some P's. Again, P's are the nice case because we know all children of P's must be N's. So, right, this child and that child must be N's. Well, now let's look at these two nodes. Again, same argument we had before. This is an N, so it's got to have some P. It can't be this guy. This guy we already know is an N. So one of these has got to be P. But they're symmetric, right? This is the same as that, red backwards, and with blue changed to red. So if one of these must be P, and they have to have equal value, they must both be P. Well, now we have two P's. P's only have N children. Now we have a problem. What's the problem? Look at this node here. It's an N. Look at all its children. N, N, N. Can't have that, right? N has got to have at least one P child. Just doesn't work. So we have a contradiction. Open question time. So, the open question I started with. What happens in general? We don't know. We can say a little bit about playing on other partially ordered sets. Whoopsie, wrong way. So here's a particular one that I like. Suppose capital N is at least Mn plus 1, and suppose you're playing on Bn. B sub n is the Boolean algebra on n elements. So write all subsets of an n element set ordered by inclusion. The winner is always B. That's proved by a nice little strategy stealing argument. And using the fact that the Boolean algebra has a very nice involution on it, namely complementation. And let's end with this slide.
Are there any questions?
Yes, we're waiting for Andreas. We have to give him more than 2 minutes. It usually took a day or two.